Just add to the miracles associated with Hanukkah, the miracle which transformed the weary, dirty, tired, bedraggled troops of Judah when they came into Jerusalem into these fresh-faced, clear-eyed, beautiful young people. And I guess someplace in that miracle is the secret of Jewish survival. As the snows fell these last days, I kept reminding myself that King David never had to shovel out the driveways of his palace, and that the high priest in Jerusalem never had to worry that the cars might not be able to make the turnaround. In Israel, as you know, there are no blizzards. The snows fall occasionally in the hills of Judea. But like snow in the Sun Belt of the United States, it hardly touches the ground before it disappears. And so one of the unexpected features of our Bible is the 147th Psalm, in which God is praised for his creative majesty, and the terms of the praise are in terms of the snowstorm, the blizzard, and in terms of the bringing of the snow, which allows the rains which replenish the earth, and the bringing of the sun, which melt the snows, which allow us to go about our usual tasks. The last part of the Psalter is a series of praise psalms, the Hallelujah Psalms, and Psalm 147 reads this way. Sing to the Lord, Jerusalem, O Zion, praise your God. For he sends his command to the ends of the earth, and his words run swiftly. He showers down snow, white as wool. He sprinkles frost, thick as ashes. Crystals of ice he scatters like breadcrumbs. He sends the cold, and the waters stand frozen. He utters his word, and the ice is melted. He blows his winds, and the waters flow. O praise the Lord. As I thought of the snow and of this psalm and the unexpectedness of this psalm in the Bible, I thought of this concept of the unexpected. Hanukkah comes unexpectedly early this year. Somehow it's unexpected to have Hanukkah more associated with Thanksgiving than with Christmas. It's very good that way, but it's unexpected. And it's unexpected to have this kind of blizzard and snowfall and cold this early in the year. And it is unexpected for us to be thinking of peace in the Middle East. And so I bethought myself of Hanukkah and of the strange fact, when I put my mind to it, that the two material objects most associated with Hanukkah, the menorah and the little top, the dreidel, are both well-known and familiar items which have a surprising and unexpected history. And it's to that unexpected history that I'd like to devote our attention for a few minutes this morning. Hanukkah, as you know, celebrates the rededication and the purification of the temple in Jerusalem by the Judeans under Judah the Maccabee in the year 164 before the Common Era. The lights of Hanukkah are explained by our prayer book as associated with that moment of rededication. But what is unexpected is that we have an eyewitness account of the rededication of the temple, and that eyewitness account makes no mention of a menorah, of an 8-branched or a 9-branched candlestick. Nor do any of the subsequent records and histories of Hanukkah during the first 400 or 500 years of existence mention the menorah. It simply appears someplace in the 3rd century in a Talmudic text. It appears already well and known among the Jewish people, a familiar object on Hanukkah. But what does it mean, and how did it come into being? The second book of Maccabees is a rather contemporaneous account of the struggle against the Syrian Greeks. The Syrian Greeks ruled from North Turkey to the gates of Egypt in the second millennium before the Common Era. Judah was a small protectorate within that kingdom. In the middle of the second century before the Common Era, Antiochus V, who was known as Epimenes, suffered a series of reversals. He had great imperial ambitions. He marched his army into Egypt, and he was about to defeat the Egyptians when suddenly the Council of the Roman Republic appeared and ordered him to leave Egypt. He was the first of the Eastern potentates to face the might of Rome, and he had to turn tail and return to Damascus. He was bitter and an angry man, and somehow along the way he involved himself in the petty internecine politics of Jerusalem. There were always great battles in those centuries over who and which family was to secure the high priesthood. And for reasons which escape us now, Antiochus involved himself in those squabbles, that attempt to gain rank. And he became so angry with the Judeans and so embittered by their pettiness and that he became convinced of their disloyalty. And he ordered that a great statue, the statue of his patron god, Zeus Olympios, be erected in the temple and that sacrifices be offered to this god. And of course, this violated the second commandment and violated everything that was essential to the spirit of Judaism. And though the sycophants among the upper class were willing to go along, the ordinary people were not, and a provincial priest by the name of Mattathias encouraged his sons to undertake a guerrilla warfare against the Syrian Greeks. And because Antiochus had acted out of anger born out of political weakness, these guerrillas under Judah were able to force their way back within a 3-year period into Jerusalem and to retake the Temple Mount and to rededicate and purify the altar. And the account of that great day in the 25th of Kislev, which was, I think, the 12th or 13th of December of the year 164 before the Common Era, reads this way. Thereupon Judah and his brothers said, "Now our enemies have been defeated. Let us go purify the sanctuary and restore it." The entire army assembled, and they went up to Mount Zion. They saw the temple laid desolate, the altar profaned, and the gates burned. They rent their garments and made great lamentation and put on ashes. Judah appointed unblemished priests who purified the sanctuary and removed the stones of the loathsome structures to an unclean place. They deliberated over what they should do with the profaned altar, and they came up with a good idea of dismantling it, lest the fact that the Gentiles had defiled it should be held to their disgrace. Accordingly, they dismantled the altar and put its stones away on the Temple Mount in a suitable place. Taking new uncut stones, as prescribed by the Torah, they built a new altar after the pattern of the old. They repaired the sanctuary and sanctified the interior of the house and the courts. They also made new sacred vessels, and they brought the great menorah and the altar of incense and the table into the nave. They burned incense on the altar and kindled the lights on the great 7-branched candelabrum, and so they illumined the nave of the temple. They set loaves upon the table and hung the curtains and brought to completion all the work which they had done. They rose early in the morning of the 25th day of the 9th month, and they brought a sacrifice according to the Torah upon the new altar. At the very time of the year and the very day on which the Gentiles had profaned the altar, it was dedicated to the sound of singing and harps and lyres and cymbals. And the people gave thanks to heaven who had brought them victory. And they celebrated the dedication of the altar for 8 days, joyfully bringing burnt offerings and sacrificing peace offerings and thank offerings. And Judah and his brothers and the entire assembly of Israel declared that the days of the dedication of the altar should be observed at their time of year annually for 8 days, beginning with the 25th day of the month of Kislev, that they should be observed with joy and gladness. There you have the first Hanukkah. Hanukkah means simply dedication. The first Hanukkah was a rededication of the altar and of the temple, the relighting of the great 7-branched menorah, the putting of the 12 loaves of bread, the showbread upon the showbread table, and doing all those things which allowed the temple practice to continue as it had before. And for the first 200 and some odd years of its existence until the temple was destroyed in the year 70 of the Common Era, this was the celebration of Hanukkah. It was temple-centered, it was priest-led, it had to do with the purification of the temple in 164. There were special Thanksgiving psalms recited. There was probably a kindling of the great menorah, the great 7-branch candelabra, but there was no Hanukkiah, no 8 or 9-branch menorah. And there was nothing popular, nothing in the home, nothing in the synagogue associated with Hanukkah. It was a temple-centered ceremony. Whence then this 9-branched Hanukkiah, or menorah? In the 3rd century, in a school in Babylon, One of the sages put to his class the question, "My Hanukkah, what is the explanation of these lights?" And by way of answer, when the class couldn't come up with a very good explanation, this sage explained that these lights stand for a miracle which took place back then during the first celebration of Hanukkah. Judah had wanted to get the altar rebuilt as quickly as possible, the cult reestablished. The altar required these new stones. The lights required a special fluid, for the Torah law is very precise. In Leviticus, we read that to light the menorah, the great seven-branch candelabra, you have to take shemen zayit zach katit lamaor, a special kind of olive oil, which has been specially mollified and prepared for the great light of the temple. And they looked for fluid which had been prepared properly, and they found one little cruse of oil, which according to this legend was sufficient to last only for one day, but by some miracle, by God's miracle, according to the explanation the sage offered, it lasted for the 8 days. Now this is the basis of our present popular conventional understanding of Hanukkah. It symbolizes God's protective might, the miracles he performs for the faith and for the faithful, and the lights, the 8 days, represent this little cruse of oil which miraculously lengthened its ability to give light, to shed light for the 8 days. Now the only problem with this story is it doesn't appear in the eyewitness account. And obviously if a miracle of this type had been performed, it would have been the first thing to be enshrined in such an account. Indeed, we have every reason to believe that they looked for a miracle at the time of the rededication, because the Bible indicates that when the temple was first dedicated, a great miracle took place. And when the second temple was dedicated after the Babylonian exile, again a miracle took place. And that they had been in fact disappointed when the day had passed simply in the acts which they had determined for it. So the menorah appears from some other source. And we believe now, and this is the unexpected history of the familiar menorah in your home, that the menorah grew out of a popular custom associated with the winter solstice. This is the time when the days grow shorter, when we approach the 21st of December, the shortest day of the year. And throughout Western Asia, throughout the Middle East, at this time of the year, people lit bonfires and candles in order to remind the sun to replenish its strength. As the days grew shorter, as the sun grew weaker, people became more and more fearful that the sun may simply grow weaker and weaker and weaker, and ultimately darkness enveloped the earth. And so almost every primitive people had a form of sympathetic magic by which they tried to encourage the sun to break forth again into its power, in which they tried to remind the sun that they would need it in the year that was about to dawn. And so some ceremony of light kindling. And if you read the Talmud, and I hope someday some of you will at least open the covers and look in it, you'll find a very interesting debate among some of the rabbis as to how we should go about lighting these lights. The question is not should we light them from the right side first and then to the left, or from the left side and then to the right, but the question is should we light one light on the first day and two on the second the way we do now, or as one school of rabbis believe, should we light all 8 lights the first night, 7 the second, 6 the third, until 1 on the last day. And behind this custom, which neither of these groups really understand, they have no explanation of why they do it, seems to be some local habit, some local ceremony, in which the 8 days before the winter solstice, they would light down the candle, 8 lights, 7 lights, 6 lights, less and less light. And then as the day lengthened, the sun grew stronger, and they had hope again for the year. 1 light on the solstice day, 2 lights the next day, 3 the next, until they were confident after 8 days that spring would, in time, come again. What we have here, in other words, is originally a great popular concern for sun and light, for the day, and a sense that somehow man must participate by lending his strength to the sun and to the day in order to reestablish their superiority over darkness in the night. And somehow over the long centuries, what seems to have happened is this, that while in December the Hanukkah was being celebrated in the temple, out there in the diaspora, wherever Jews lived, they celebrated in a popular way, not necessarily a Jewish way, this solstice candle lighting. And as is the way with customs, we allied one popular custom with another. And somehow, since Hanukkah came at this time of the year, somebody began to talk of Hanukkah during the bonfire, during the lighting of the candles. And when the temple was destroyed, there remained only the bonfire, only the menorah, the eight branches, only this popular custom, which now carried with it all of the overtones and all of the meaning of the Hanukkah. For there was no temple in which to celebrate the Hanukkah as it had been first devoted. And so the menorah begins out there in the Gentile world and moves into our world and now carries with it the overtones, the lesson of Hanukkah, an unexpected beginning for this very familiar ceremonial object. But what of this object? The top, the dreidel. We all know it. We think of it as a child's toy. Usually today we have a dreidel which opens up and we fill it with nuts or with chocolate and we give it to the children. And we think of it as the way in which we carry on the injunction which we found during that first Hanukkah for this to be a day of joy and gladness, a festivity day, a festival day, a happy day. And we know, if we think about it, that the top is part of a little game, child's game of put and take, so many nuts or so many marbles in a pot. And there are four letters, as you know, on the sides of the menorah, Nun, Gimel, He, and Shin, which rabbis very deliberately explain stands for the Hebrew phrase, Nes Gadol Hayasham, that there was a miracle at that place and in those days. And the Nun, if you get the Nun when you spin it, nothing happens, it's nisht. If you get the Gimel, Gadol, you take the whole pot, and Hay stands for Halb, for half, and you play a little game with marbles or pennies or something of this kind. And it all seems very nice and very innocent and very appropriate to a holiday which in our times has become largely a children's holiday. But actually, and this is the unexpected part of this dreidel represents an attempt by the rabbis to cure the most pernicious of vices among Jews in the Middle Ages, the vice of gambling. Jews were terrible gamblers. If you read the moral literature of our people, you find that from the 3rd or 4th century to the 19th century, if there's any theme that Jews, the rabbis, the teachers, the parents, the grandparents, whoever felt he was above the vice, talked about, it was the vice of gambling. These were the centuries in which sufferance was the badge, in which our people lived a totally insecure life. They couldn't own land, they were not citizens, they could be exiled from the country at the whim of the emperor. They were not allowed to engage in most professions, as you know. Money was all they could work for, and money could be extracted from them by the will of the tax master, by the emperor's demands. There was no guarantee, there was no security. They learned to live at the edge of despair. They learned that all life is a gamble, and some of them became so addicted to gambling that they couldn't relax even in their homes, even in their free time. We hear of them gambling day in and day out at cards. We hear of them gambling day in and day out with dice. We hear of them gambling at tennis. We found, interestingly, those of you who love tennis, that in the town of Cremona in Italy in the 16th and 17th century, the Jewish community owned a tennis court. And the rabbis finally forced the Jewish community to sell the tennis court because the Jews were playing tennis and gambling at such high stakes that whole families were bankrupted by a tennis game. Now, we find in the Middle Ages attempts to prohibit gambling, and as with prohibition with alcohol in our society, that didn't work. We find attempts at moralizing at gambling, and that didn't do too much. And so we find that the last thing the rabbis tried to do was to take gambling from the forbidden and from the everyday and bring it into the synagogue, bring it into and under and within the constraints of faith. And throughout Jewry in Europe, in the Middle Ages, you'll find attempts to bring gambling into Purim, bring gambling into Hanukkah, bring gambling into the intermediate days of Sukkot and the Passover, in order to limit gambling, so you don't gamble all the days of the year, and in order to bring gambling into the context where people would have some restraint. After all, in the synagogue, there are other vibrations in the air, and they're not the same vibrations as in your basement around the felt table. And so, during the Middle Ages, these holidays became holidays in which gambling was permitted. And this dreidel is originally a gambler's device. It's known as a Trendel in Germany. It was known as the teetotum in England. They had the same four sides to their top, and that one was the T for take. Totem is the Latin word all. T takes all. So it's called teetotum in English. And we've even found dreidels, not Jewish dreidels, fortunately, but German dreidels, which are weighted so that they'll fall one way or the other. And what the rabbis did was to try and bring this vice under some kind of restraints by permitting it on certain occasions, in certain conditions, and by somehow associating it with holidays where, hopefully, the people would be reminded that there were higher values and higher virtues. And so they took the four sides and they wrote an acronym about the Hanukkah. There was a great miracle in those days, Nes Gadol Hayasham. Actually, in German, this was nicht, this was gibt, nothing, take, halb, half, stell, place. And all of these four sides were simply the sides which the gamblers were very familiar with. There was no candy in the dreidel in those days. So what we have in these two objects, which are very familiar to us from Hanukkah, the menorah and the dreidel, is the unexpected. And the unexpected is simply people. The unexpected is the individuality of the human being. The unexpected is that part of us which does not conform to our assumptions, or our assumptions that we are saints, or that we are sinners, our assumptions that all wisdom comes from the higher faith rather than from the popular culture. What we have in Hanukkah is another example of the fact that as people, as in every generation, we have celebrated the Hanukkah as a 4th of July, as a great theme of redemption, independence, our ability to worship God in our own way. There's been the high road, and there's been the low road. But even the low road itself was an attempt to bring us up from our failings and foibles and to help us to live life with some degree of dignity. And to me, the interesting thing about history is always that it introduces us to the unexpected. And it reminds us that behind the old and the familiar, there's a long and involved history, the history of people, the complexity which is human life. And that's both the drama and the hope and the fact we will never realize our total hope, which is part of life itself.